forward additional amendments to try to address some of our concerns. With that being said, let me get into the Dash 4 quickly, because I know you've got a big agenda today, Mr. Chair. The Dash 4 amendments put on paper what I mentioned yesterday would be a viable alternative to this particular bill, where you have a state agency basically being deputized to enforce the federal recall law. In this particular amendment, the Dash 4, that state agency is the Department of Consumer and Business Services, where they would be able to investigate at any time a retailer and examine the retailer's books, records, accounts, files, or inventories in order to try to determine if that retailer was in violation of the recall list by having one of these items for sale in that particular store. The DCBS would then set it up under the Administrative Procedures Act for a contested case proceeding. If they found that there was reasonable suspicion to believe that the retailer was in violation of this particular act, and then it would be set up for a contested case hearing, which, as you know, provides the retailer with due process and all the other rights that they should be given pursuant to the Administrative Procedures Act. It's a hearing in front of an impartial hearings officer appointed by the hearings officer's panel, and then if the retailer is found to be in violation of the act, they can get penalized by the DCBS, and it looks here like they can get penalties assessed to them, and I would argue they probably should be able to obtain an injunction, other corrective action. But the key to this particular route, to deputizing the state agency, is you are keeping it within the government realm. You are not providing a new cause of action, which is our biggest concern with the bill and even with the Dash 5 amendment. What would happen when you have a new cause of action under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act?
Mr. Levy, excuse me for a minute. My due diligence, I caught myself that I would like to open a work session on House Bill 3631. Continue, please.
Say everything you just said.
Thank you, Chair Holmey. I incorporate by reference all of my prior testimony before the work session began. That being said, what the Dash 4 amendment would do is it would give the authority to a state agency to enforce this law, and I believe that is the intent of this committee and of this bill. The underlying intent is to get this material off the shelves, to protect our children. I've got a 5-year-old at home. I know the list. I've looked at the list. I'm sure that we probably have toys in somewhere in our house that may be on that list. I, you know, still haven't found all the toys in our house. That being said, this is a serious issue. I did, Representative Gilliam, I did go on to Google last night. I could not find any specific cases here in Oregon, but it is a serious issue with children getting sick, swallowing magnets, etc. I've seen the articles from the rest of the country, and I want to assure this committee that NFIB is very acutely aware that this problem needs to be addressed. We are just worried about the idea of having this private cause of action where an innocent merchant who made an honest mistake could get zinged for damages and attorney's fees and theoretically be put out of business because they made an honest mistake. And that is our biggest concern. I think that in a contested case proceeding where you have an agency weighing the facts, that risk is much smaller. Under an Unlawful Trade Practices Act, that risk is much greater because, again, by virtue of putting the item on the shelf, under this bill, under this statutory framework that you would be creating, that merchant will have violated the act and then be liable under the act. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Levy. I just want to clarify. So the Dash 4 Amendment completely takes out the private right of action?
Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Bonamici, that was the intent. Okay. I just received it myself. So if it doesn't, then it's not germane to what we were looking for. But it's supposed to provide this right to a state agency to go out and enforce the federal recall list.
A follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
And did you work with DCBS on this to make sure that this is something that they have the adequate staff and get a fiscal and everything so that we could... determine if they have the resources to do this type of work?
Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Bonamici, no, I have not spoken with DCBS yet. This was the agency that we thought would be most appropriate for this. I am not wedded to any particular agency. I just think it should be with an instrument of the state government that has this authority.
Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Galizio?
That was going to be my question. Thank you.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony, Harlan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, I'd like to call up Andrew Scholl.
Thank you, Chair Holvey.
Representatives of the committee. Andrew Scholl, Oregon Department of Justice, Financial Fraud, Consumer Protection Section. I can let you know that I haven't had a long opportunity to review the Dash 4s, but since it would not be a Department of Justice purview, I'll leave that for others. With that, I'm essentially here to answer questions. I did want to touch base on behalf of Representative Nelson. She had talked about other states' legislation yesterday, and we had gotten an email out with some of that information attached to it, but we did want to specify that the other states right now that have some form of children's product safety law on the books are Illinois, Michigan, Vermont, Louisiana, Arkansas, Missouri, Rhode Island, and New Jersey. And some of those are unlawful trade practices enforced through the Attorney General. Some are administrative along the lines of what you just heard. There are even a couple of states who have made it criminal, that have made one of the penalties incarceration. So with that, I'll open it up to questions. On the exact question that I believe Representative Nelson was going for, which was private rights of action, correct me if I'm wrong, Representative Nelson, but I cannot find a private right of action that's independent of sort of other states' torts actions and commercial regulations that are associated with these children's products safety liability acts.
Thank you. You have looked at the Dash 5 amendment and its impact on the bill. I believe it removes Section 4 of the bill, the constructive the presumption of constructive knowledge, as
correct.
You'd like to call it.
Correct. And Chair Holvey, the Dash 5s are, of course, fine to us. We would still support the bill. The Section 4 was a presumption. It was a burden-shifting provision. But the end result, which is the elements of the UTPA, would still be either ourselves or a private litigant would need to show the willful standard under the UTPA, under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. And again, that's defined as new or should have known. So it's very close to merely negligence.
But and my point is that the shift of burden now within the Dash in the Dash 5s now is taken reverse back, so that can you explain that?
Correct. That's the essential function is rather than a defendant, which in this case would be a retailer, having to overcome the presumption, having the duty to overcome the presumption, it's shifted back to the plaintiff or the state of Oregon, the attorney general or district attorney, to again show the willful element of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, the new or should have known standard.
And then specifically, there used to be a Dash 1 that's also included in the Dash 5 amendment, which just brings up the authority of DHS with their product laws, that they have a lead program where they look at toys specifically, and this bill doesn't negatively impact or curtail any of those statutes or
Chair Holvey, that is how I understand it. The Dash 1s were originally a technical fix proposed by legislative counsel just to ensure that the reference of those DHS programs were incorporated into the law. But the removal of the Section 4 should not have any effect on that.
Thank you. Further questions from to Mr. Scholl? Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Scholl, thank you very much for following up. And I always appreciate that.
You're welcome. We try to be as quick as we can. For Representative Gilliam, I will say we are still working with the Consumer Product Safety Commission in trying to get his Oregon-specific numbers.
Thank you.
And my question to you, having reviewed these other states, I am just concerned that we are rushing through a piece of legislation that isn't what we really want. And for example, if I could just give you this example, the state of Washington, and there's the statement is, it's not just a retailer. It says if a manufacturer, importer, wholesaler, or distributor of children's products is placed into the stream of commerce in our state, a children's product for which a recall or warning has subsequently been issued by any of them that I just mentioned, that person must initiate the following steps within 24 hours after issuing or receiving the recall or the warning. And then it goes through them, you know, contact all the commercial customers. If you maintain it on a website, you have to go to the website. If a manufacturer sold directly to a non-commercial customer, same thing. If a retailer receives a notice of a recall, again, this is his option. One, within 3 business days after receiving the recall or the warning from any of those people, he must remove these from the shelf. If he used his web, you know, he has 3 business days to get it up on the web and post it. And then, furthermore, it goes into what the agency should be doing. And also, this includes child care facilities. I mean, this is just seems so much more applicable to what we're trying to do. We're trying to protect the children. And so it talks about child care providers, how they must get the list. They assess it. I think that should include pre-K, you know, the elementary school. And then finally, it directs the state, the secretary's office, to establish and maintain a product safety education campaign. And a comprehensive list posted on the web and, you know, following through. And those dollars for these recalls don't come from the taxpayer. They come from the manufacturer, distributor, et cetera. So don't you think that was a much more solid, valuable piece of legislation than what we've just done, just pinpointing a retailer?
Chair Halvey, Representative Nelson, I absolutely agree that those are far more comprehensive bills. I would also draw your attention to the Illinois statute. I believe that was one of the copies I was able to provide you in hard copy format, and many have termed it as sort of the ultimate Children's Product Safety Act in terms of state legislation. And I think my response to you needs to be qualified in the sense that it's important to remember that here, what's being asked is simply a piece of that, a step to what may be a larger solution. But almost all those pieces of legislation involved a large outlay of money by the state in order to involve either departments of health or promulgate rules or set up the proper procedures for how those statutes would operate. And what was being thought about with this provision, with this proposed bill, is one step in the right direction. Make it a mandate. Make a specific violation of law to help get those off of the shelves, get those recalled items for children's products, you know, just the children's products, off of the shelves. So I would ask that you look at it in terms of simply being one piece of the puzzle, and not that it's the final answer, which you're absolutely right. If it were the final answer, it would simply be a less inclusive bill.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I look forward to working on some of the ideas that Representative Nelson talked about for the 2009 session when we have time and hopefully resources. But for now, I believe this is a great first step that will protect a lot of children here in Oregon. And, Mr. Chair, at this time, I'd like to move that we adopt the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 3631.
Representative Bonamici moves the adoption of the Dash 5 amendments into House Bill 3631. Discussion? Seeing none, I believe we'll have a roll call vote on this. If the assistant would call the roll on the adoption of the Dash 1, or Dash 5, amendments.
Representative Bonamici?
Aye.
Representative Lilly Hale?
Aye.
Representative Killian?
No.
Nelson?
No.
Riley?
Aye.
Brenner?
No.
Chair Holby?
Aye. The Dash 5 amendments are adopted into House Bill 3631. Mm-hmm. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that we pass House Bill 36, send House Bill 36, excuse me, it's been a while. House Bill 3631 is amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Bonamici moves House Bill 3631 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Recognizing that we did talk about this, I don't know exactly when, but in the interim, I still want to say that it started moving pretty fast, and I'm sorry we moved so quickly to five. I'm also sorry that my amendments came so late, but I thought we would have a chance maybe to let folks absorb those a little bit, because my goal, which four or five may be imperfect in getting to, is to take the private right of action out, to get rid of the construct knowledge, so that we don't leave this gaping hole for litigation. Because I don't hear anybody on this panel saying our purpose here is to prop up trial lawyers. Our purpose here is to take very dangerous toys off the shelf. And I felt like, not that it's a perfect piece of work here, but I felt like if we could get to the investigative piece and a mechanism for enforcement. And again, I would echo what Mr. Levy said. We didn't have a chance because of the timing to talk to DCPS. Because of my experience with the directors here today, because of my experience in this committee, I felt like that would be the logical place and that they would be the right enforcement agency, that we could still get to where we all want to go without this gaping litigation hole, in my view. And I think if we move ahead here with the amendments that we just passed, that we're missing the point. And I wanted to make sure I put that on the record. I know you're moving ahead, but the amendments went really fast.
I appreciate your comments. We have taken, to correct you, we have taken the presumption of constructive knowledge out of this bill and the Dash 5 amendments, seeing that that was the major objection that we heard from the industry.
I'm sorry, you're right.
You know, this is a special session where we are on a time schedule to move things along, and there's another side to this building where people can continue to advocate for their positions on bills that move out of this committee and potentially move off the floor. There's still, that's part of the process, but we have a long agenda, and we're going to try to do the best we can. And from my perspective, from my policy point of view, I think this is an excellent policy decision and an excellent bill that will do the job of protecting children. And whether it's 20,000 children or one children, all it takes in my mind is one. And I think this is something we really need to get through this special session. And in that vein, I'm going to represent Bonamici.
I'll pass on my comments. You addressed mine.
Oh, excuse me. Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly believe that we have to be the voice for the children, like I said yesterday, and we must protect them, and they need us. I am concerned that we have targeted one entity involved in the distribution of toys or objects or materials that could be hazardous to the health of our children. I am, and as you know, I have recommended that we you know, hold off on this vote until we have truly reviewed these other laws. We've made this, an issue that the whole of Oregon would have to support. The manufacturers, I mean, as well as the distributors, as well as the retailers, as well as the parents, child care centers, and school officials. So I'm very sad that we're not going to do that, so it's not comprehensive to me, and I really feel that that would be the best way to approach this issue.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. I will commit to continue to work on making this a more comprehensive act, but as has been mentioned, I think this is a big step in the correct direction, and it may not be the last step. For sure, but this is something we think we can do right now without a huge revenue impact to the state. Won't cost taxpayers a lot of money, and we'll do the job of taking products off the shelf. And I think that's our goal, is to get the dangerous products off the shelf and get them out of the hands of children, potentially. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make a comment. I want to, first of all, echo what Representative Nelson is saying, that we have a ways to go. This is a first step, and I hope that she'll join us in taking this first step, but it is a first step, and we do have a long way to go. This is a very important first step.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to make one brief comment about the effect of having the private cause of action in the unlawful trade practices. And I made this point yesterday, and we'll make it again just briefly. There's already a couple of pages of requirements for businesses in Oregon under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act about things that are considered to be unlawful trade practices. And the businesses in the state are already complying with those and required to comply with those. This isn't adding a huge responsibility. It's something that we're adding that will protect our children in the state. And it's not a new law. It's one addition to the Unlawful Trade Practices Act that they're already required to comply with. And I do support taking out the actual or constructive knowledge provision as a compromise in that. I think it would have made it easier for the Attorney General and for people who were injured under this act, but I support taking that out as in the spirit of compromise, and will support the Dash 5 amendments and the bill.
Okay, discussion. Representative Gilliam, another comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are good compromises, and there are not so good compromises, but the main thing is there are compromises, so I appreciate the part that we the ground that we have covered, and I will be supporting the bill.
Thank you. Seeing no further discussion, Susan, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Delizio?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Nelson?
Aye.
Representative Riley?
Aye.
Representative Springer?
Aye.
Representative Bonamici?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. Should we put this on the consent calendar?
No.
I think the chair will carry this bill on the floor. The House Bill 3631, having received the required votes, is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. With that, I would close the work session on House Bill 3631. I'm going to look the committee administrator to get the brief,
okay.
And then we'll turn it over to you.
You can start with Lisa.
Thank you.
was from this list. I don't see Chris Ambrose signed up. What you can do, what I would suggest you do is ask Corey to ask if anybody else has changed.
Okay, so go down that path. I'm gonna start out here, and then I'll give it to you, and then we'll give it to Suzanne. I would like to open a public hearing on House Bill 3630. Members, since we met last June, the crisis of mortgage lending issue has reached a critical stage across the country, and we did deal with a bill last session that had many elements. That was Senate Bill 965 when we first started having conversations about this topic. And I was elated to have the governor select a bipartisan governor's task force on mortgage lending. And they have agreed to a series of steps to aid people who face foreclosure of their homes. And last year, home foreclosures in Oregon rose 12.5%, and the year before, foreclosures rose by more than 50%. And thousands of Oregon families face the very issues we are looking at today as subprime rates adjust, and they face very real threat of seeing their monthly payments rise so high they will be forced out of their homes. We're tackling the issue of mortgage rescue scams in this bill, that House Bill 3630. And as well the manner in which people are notified about pending foreclosure and very specific information that must be provided to them to help them avoid foreclosure. I feel this is a very meaningful bill that will immediately begin helping those people who are furthest down the road to losing their homes. This again is a consensus bill coming out of the governor's mortgage lending task force. At least we think for the most part it's consensus. I know there's still a few unresolved topics out there, but I think we'll be able to move something through that everybody can agree on, hopefully. And I just want to thank the Department of Consumer and Business Services and heading up this task force, the governor, and all those from industry and consumer groups who have really done a stellar job of bringing these issues up. This is a very real bill, and I think it's a great testament to people coming together to solve a problem. And really appreciate specifically Chris Ambrose and Representative Bonamici for heading up some of the hard work in the subcommittees on in this task force. And with that, I'm going to let Jim Stembridge just give a brief overview of the bill.
Chair Holby, members, this is House Bill 3630. It regulates home mortgage loan foreclosure consultants and equity purchasers. It specifies provisions that must be contained in foreclosure consulting and equity conveyance contracts. Requires foreclosure consulting contracts to include full description of services to be provided, total amount and terms of the compensation, and the information on homeowner's right to cancel the contract. Requires foreclosure consulting contracts be in plain language delivered to homeowners at least 24 hours before the homeowners sign. It lists specific actions prohibited, including taking the power of attorney. It makes violations of foreclosure consulting or equity conveyance laws into unfair trade practices. Requires lenders to provide homeowners who are at risk of mortgage foreclosure with notice, including information on how to stop the foreclosure process. It applies to foreclosure consulting contracts beginning 90 days after the enactment, and it declares emergency effective upon passage.
Thank you. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to go down there.
Our first testifier. Go ahead when you're ready, but please introduce yourself for the record.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, I'm Suzanne Bonamici, State Representative from House District 34. And I'm here to encourage you to support House Bill 3630 with the -1 amendments. I wanted to introduce you to this bill. I've been spending a lot of time with it over the past several months. This is a bill in response to the subprime crisis that we've been hearing about on a daily basis. Every time you open the newspaper, turn on the news, you'll hear something about the ramifications of the subprime crisis. And when we started talking about this concept, I did some looking around in newspapers and on telephone poles. As you start looking around in your communities, you'll start seeing signs that are geared toward the people who are in crisis now, facing foreclosure. Signs that say, "We'll save your home. Facing foreclosure? Call me now. Avoid foreclosure? I can help you." And what we did with this bill is try to address some of those unscrupulous among the foreclosure rescuers. And the bill is really in three parts, but the first two concepts deal with foreclosure consultants and equity purchasers. And foreclosure consultants are the people who offer the help. And what we heard is oftentimes they offer the help, the homeowner pays the money, and then gets virtually nothing in return. The equity purchaser section, or equity conveyance section, deals with a common scheme of having the homeowner actually transfer the title to the property to the person who's purporting to help them, and then enter into a leaseback situation. And what these homeowners are told is, "I'll save your house for you. You can stay in your house, and at the end, you can get your house back." But oftentimes, they do not. They end up losing their homes. And so the restrictions on that second part of transaction, the equity conveyance, are much stricter. Representative Riley will be pleased to know that there's many plain language forms both in the foreclosure consultant and in the equity conveyance sections of the bill. We tried very hard to make sure that those notices that are given to the homeowners are done in language that they can understand. And the third part of the bill is a notice that improves the information that homeowners get when they're facing foreclosure. I was surprised to learn during our work group meetings that as many as 50% of people facing foreclosure never even make a phone call to their lender to find out what they can do. And part of that, we perceived, was a lack of helpful information about who to call and what they could do. So we've devised a notice that will give them very helpful information, including some, for example, legal assistance, community housing resources, so that they have a place to start in addressing their needs. I know there's more to do in this area, but I'm pleased to say that this is a bill that has broad support across the consumer groups and the industry, and I've enjoyed working on it and look forward to hearing the testimony today and urge you to support this very important bill. Thank you, and I'd be happy to address your questions.
Thank you, Representative, for your work and your introduction to this. It's very helpful. I think we'll probably hold off on questioning you right now, though. Oh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Oh. Saved you. Mr. Stembridge, would you maybe give us a heads up about what the Dash 1 amendment is as well?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The bill itself is the product of an early recommendation and a continuing work group. After the bill was printed, the work group continued. The Dash 1 amendment, which has been distributed here, represents further work of the work group. So there are quite a large number of wording changes. Most of them are relatively minor wording changes, but Legislative Council chose to, for our convenience, to make the Dash 1 a replacement for the measure. So everything that would be in a final bill, should you choose to pass it out, is in the Dash 1 amendment.
Thank you. With that, I think next up on our list, Jim, was Corey Streisinger, I believe. And anybody you'd like to bring with you.
Mr. Ambrose and Mr. Carnes may be appropriate to come up with.
Fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I appreciate the opportunity to be here in support of House Bill 3630. And I wanted to express my appreciation for the efforts of the work group that led to this bill. One of the questions that we were asked when this bill was introduced actually was for a little more background on who participated in the work group, and you will see attached to my testimony a list of work group participants, although it's actually not a complete list because we had many people who attended portions of various meetings and provided very useful insights. I think this is a great example of folks throughout the industry and consumer representatives and, of course, members of this body giving their time to work through a set of issues to come up with a good work product. I very much appreciate it, and I particularly appreciate the chair's participation and, of course, Representative Bonamici's participation. She probably spent more hours and knows more about this topic than any of the rest of us. So the bill that's before you is one of two bills that came out of the work group. The other one is over on the Senate side. It's Senate Bill 1064. It deals with enforcement and loan originator issues. This bill, as has been mentioned, deals with foreclosures. When this bill was introduced, I provided some statistics on the foreclosure situation in Oregon. Also attached to my testimony is a summary of what's going on with foreclosures and delinquencies in Oregon right now. Suffice it to say that it is a growing problem, although Oregon has been fortunate in not facing the extent of foreclosures that other states have seen so far. Our best numbers at the moment are predicting about 12,000 foreclosures over the next couple of years. Of course, this is an issue that's getting attention nationally. With the interest rate cuts recently, it may be that some people have the ability to refinance at lower rates if their credit is good enough, but most of the people facing foreclosures are those with poor credit, and right now the subprime lending market simply does not exist in any meaningful way, so that many of the people at risk with loans that are going to see spiking interest rates don't have a lot of options at this point, even though the adjustment may be to a lower number than it would have been otherwise. This problem is attracting attention across the country, of course. And again, one of the attachments to my testimony is an issue brief from the National Conference of State Legislators summarizing what other states are doing to address foreclosure issues. And if you look at that, you'll see a lot of familiar topics because we are addressing a number of them in this bill, the issue of the mortgage rescue schemes, the foreclosure consultants, and counseling resources and information in the hands of people who are facing foreclosure. There are actually ways to protect people and to help people avoid foreclosure. Other states have been looking at them as well, and the work group spent a lot of time developing this bill to respond. Again, one of the attachments to my testimony is a list of foreclosure counseling resources. It's also available on our website, but this is the type of information that we will be making available through the foreclosure notice part of this bill. And if any of you have constituents who call you for help, I would encourage you to be welcome to call us, or of course get this information from our website. We're continuing to work with the Housing Department on identifying additional housing foreclosure counseling resources and information that can help people in this situation. So the bill in front of you does deal with the topics of the foreclosure consultants and the mortgage rescue areas, as well as additional information and notice to those facing foreclosure. As has been mentioned, there are Dash 1 amendments that represent the fine-tuning of the work group based on the original bill. Not major substantive changes from what you've heard and what's been summarized in the material, but more making sure that the bill works and that the bill addresses issues and carries out the work group intent. I will say that it is possible you will see Dash 2 amendments because I think there are some additional small drafting issues that have been identified. And of course, we will work with you and with legislative counsel to identify any of those issues as quickly as possible. So with that, I will be happy to answer any questions, or you may want to hear from the other members of the panel first.
I'd like to hear from the other members after I ask one question of you. You know, just a briefly, a potential Dash 2. So is there something that, because I've kind of followed some of the emails on the net proceeds and all that, you know, and it's pretty complex stuff, no doubt about it. But do you feel there's going to be an agreement on something that we can move forward, and if not agree on the specifics, at least to, you know, come together with a bill that gives you the authority to sort this out if the industry can't come to grips with a specific solution?
Mr. Chair, I believe the answer is that we will have something which we can heartily recommend to you to move forward with. A lot of time and energy has been put into this, and I think there's a great deal of commitment on a lot of people's part to make sure that the bill moves forward. And Mr. Ambrose may want to address that specific issue in more detail, but I think we're all committed to having a bill move forward.
Thank you for that. I'm just a little concerned about the timing is all, you know, watching our clock.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Mr. Ambrose.
Thank you, Chair Holby, Vice Chair Bonamici, members of the committee. My name is Chris Ambrose. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association, which is the Oregon affiliate of the National Mortgage Bankers Association. I'm also with Ambrose Law Group, which represents lenders and brokers. So I have some familiarity with the industry. Thank you, Representative Holby. Thank you, Representative Bonamici. As many of you know, there has been an inordinate amount of time that's been put in on that task force, along with the DCBS, consumer advocates, members of the industry, to try and come up with something that we believe is worth presenting to this this legislature and having it pass this interim session, something that will have an immediate impact from the OMLA's perspective on assisting borrowers who are in dire straits, distressed properties. The fine-tuning that has gone on has basically, in answer to your question, Chair Holby, has resulted in, I think, an agreement virtually across the board, 98%, maybe 99%. As you have seen, there has been some email communications regarding the net proceeds provision in particular, which deals with the provision in the statute that would address a recapture, if you will, by an equity seller at the end of a leaseback. I have found there to be many differences of opinion regarding what should be included in that net proceeds calculation, but having said that, I don't believe that there's anything in there that is not workable. Namely, that the intent is to come up with something to not enable an equity purchaser, the purchaser at the who's part of the leaseback, to enable that person to be able to simply mortgage the property to the hill, use it as their personal resource for lines of credit or whatever, and then ultimately have that taken out of what potentially would result in some proceeds back to the seller. So we're still fine-tuning that, but I don't believe there's anything in there that we won't be able to work through. There also are some issues dealing with the foreclosure notice, which also has become near and dear to my heart. The latest statistics, and I know everybody's seen a lot of statistics, but the latest statistics from the Mortgage Bankers Association should suggest that anywhere from 68% to 70% of borrowers who are in the midst of foreclosure either are pertain to non-owner occupied property, loans in which they are failing to comply with a prior loan modification, or more particularly, simply not responding to the request of the lender for some type of workout agreement. The biggest frustration for lenders right now, or one of the biggest, is certainly that there is a lack of response on the part of a homeowner or a borrower to come forward, especially when they're in the midst of or on the verge of foreclosure, and work with the lender into some type of workout agreement. The foreclosure notice provisions of this statute, again, I believe go a long way towards at least assisting with that problem, getting the homeowner to know what's going on so that they can approach and work with their lender. Having said that, we certainly recommend passage of House Bill 3630. With the, as Ms. Streisinger mentioned, some minor modifications.
Thank you. Mr. Carnes.
Thank you, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. My name is Keith Carnes, and I'm an attorney at Olson, Olson & Daines. I engage in a practice that deals solely with consumer issues, including many cases that deal with people's homes and lending issues and foreclosure issues and the like. I brought with me today a copy of a document that's entitled Trust Agreement. I don't know if that has been passed out. I brought this as an example of the type of things that foreclosure rescue scammers use to take people's homes. The first 12 pages of this document is a trust that my clients were induced into signing because they were facing a foreclosure within a few days. The next few documents are a deed that puts the client's home into the trust. There's a power of attorney, a revocation of the power of attorney, which was prepared, as well as a assignment of the beneficial interest of the trust. All these documents, except for the revocation of the power of attorney, were all executed on September 16th, 2007, and recorded 2 days later. My clients then tried to revoke the power of attorney and revoke the trust. However, when you look at these documents, every interest that my clients had in this home was already conveyed, and this was recorded. They gave the legal title to the trustee, and they gave their beneficial interest under the trust to the trustee all at the same time. Now, you can tell that this is absolutely fraudulent for a couple of reasons. First of all, there's a check in there, which is the entire proceeds my client received from the sale of this house. It's $15,927. So I assure you this home was worth far more than that. The second issue is that there was a due-on-sale clause that was given to lead my client to believe that when they go and sell this home, leading them to think they still owned it, that they would have to pay off this amount that they had borrowed. And secondly, there's the revocation of the power of attorney. However, they had already conveyed away this property, and there's nothing to revoke anymore. They had given it away for $15,000, $16,000. And so while there are some legitimate reasons to have people help those who are in foreclosure and have no other alternatives, you know, many of these people, as I mentioned before, have tried reorganizing through bankruptcy. They have asked their friends or their family members. They've tried loan workouts. They've tried everything they can, but they still have a hope that they can find a better job and get some employment. They may be able to overcome a sickness and get some employment and keep this house. However, they're open to being scammed. This is their last-ditch effort, and I believe that these statutes, this bill, would make it more difficult for those who are committing these scams to get away with them, but still leave it open for those who are doing a legitimate business helping these people keep their homes. Moving on to the notice provision that we've been talking about, the current notice of a foreclosure is quite a complicated document. At a firm where we do a lot of bankruptcy work and mortgage help, we receive constant calls asking, what does this mean? What do I need to do? Is my house already sold? What's going to happen? And so this is just designed to give a plain English notice of what's going to happen, let them know what their options are, to put them in touch with a lender as well as the trustee. The trustee can tell them who it is or how much they owe and who they need to pay to bring the loan current. However, as Mr. Ambrose mentioned, there's many lenders and loan servicers who want to have forbearance agreements and workout agreements, and I've seen those work successfully. This notice would put them in touch. It would give the borrower a phone number to call the loan servicer or the lender so that they can know how they can do a workout agreement and what options are available to them. It can also gives them the ability to find out how much to cure and when. I believe one of the issues is that was brought up is that the amount that's owed to bring the loan current is a moving target. The trust deed statute requires that these notices be published in the newspaper of general circulation and so on and so forth. There's all these costs that are incurred throughout the foreclosure process. One suggestion that I certainly do support is letting the borrower know that the dollar amount that's on this foreclosure notice is a moving target. It'll change daily. Literally, it'll change daily because of the interest, but also because there's going to be additional late fees and costs incurred in the foreclosure process. And so adding one sentence in there to say, in effect, that this is an amount will change daily. Please call and get an exact payoff. So that way, if they're trying to cure 3 weeks later, they don't send a check that's for an amount that was due 3 weeks earlier. Other than that, I think this is a very good notice that will answer a lot of questions and get people started in the process without the time and delay of having to talk to an attorney to consult with them or to wonder what to do next. They can just start calling the lender who is kind of the person who can give them a workout agreement. Some lenders won't do that until they're in foreclosure, and so this will help get that started. So for those reasons, I recommend passage of this bill.
Thank you very much, and again, I want to express my thanks to the three of you sitting there for your part in bringing this forward and your many hours that you've put into this. I know it's been an exercise in cooperation and hard work, too. So questions from the committee of this panel? I guess it's pretty straightforward.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
Excuse me. Next up, I'd like to bring up a panel of three, and Ron Cox, Sybil Hebb, and Gary Blackledge. Not that they're necessarily a panel together, don't mistake me. I'm just bringing up three people.
What's this guy's name?
Gary Blackledge.
That's the last one that spoke the last one here.
That was him.
Oh, that was Keith Carr.
What did he represent?
He's an attorney in private practice.
Thank the three of you for coming forward. And Mr. Knox, would you like to lead us off?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ron Knox, and it's an honor to address this committee. And I'm one of them that was scammed. It happened, I was going into foreclosure. I had people talk me into a mortgage when I was in a reverse mortgage, and to use money that I had in equity, and I couldn't afford it, but I got talked into it. And then I was going into foreclosure, and this company got it from the courthouse, I guess is where the records are, where they seen it was. And I was getting letters like crazy, we'll save your home for you, we'll do this, we'll do that. And this one company, can I mention their name, sir? Or is that legal?
You sure. Can say anything you want.
Okay, DK Investments, they become the best friends I've ever had. I mean, you couldn't ask for a better friend. I ended up... What I owed was $162,000 on my house. They sent their appraiser out, who appraised the house at $190,000. They paid off the mortgage. I had to sign my house over to them, and I was told I would get a contract to buy it back. Well, by the time they got through, my $190,000, which I thought I would get at least $25,000 or more, I ended up with $1,000. Their fees for everybody they under the sun within this group ended up with the money, and the person that ended up with the home in their name took $16,000 on top of that. I've been to court, and I got it back, and I had to sign the papers, and Mr. Gilliam, who was president of DK, was supposed to meet me in there to give me a contract back to buy my house back. He happened to be sick that day, so he said he'd meet me in a few days and we'd finish it up. He met me with not a contract but a lease option back on my house and a rental agreement. I went from an $896 payment to a $1,400 payment, over $1,400. I couldn't afford the eight. I mean, these people were my friends. So I got two payments paid in, and then I couldn't make it, and then they tried to put me out on a 72-hour notice. I was very lucky. I had got a couple attorneys that helped bypass that because they served me illegally on the 72. And then I had a Mr. Craig Colby, attorney in Portland. He's taken this to trial twice to court. The last time the court ruled, I had a mortgage, and I wasn't a renter, but I had never seen any mortgage papers to prove that I have a mortgage. I don't want to beat the people out of their money. I feel they have the $165,000 coming back. By coming here, they offered me a settlement, but by my coming here, I'm going to probably lose that settlement for telling my story. There was a confidentiality agreement if I took their settlement. But I'm at a point where $15,000 excess that I need over would bring my house back to 150. I could get it back into reverse mortgage, but it's kind of hard to find $15,000. I'm on Social Security. I'll be 75 this year. And I would just like to stay there and die at my home.
Thank you. I know it's got to be very traumatic for you, and you know, I think we can only imagine ourselves in your shoes. And you know, this is the kind of thing that this bill is designed to stop. And I know there's probably people listening in this audience that represent the industry who would like to put those people in jail just as much as you do. It just is nothing that should happen in this state or in this country. I don't know what to tell you. I hope you have a good attorney by your side and the help of any state agency that can help you. I don't know what they can do, but you know, I don't know what to tell you except try. I appreciate you coming forward, bringing us your story, because I think this really highlights what we're trying to accomplish here.
The story will be coming out in the Tribune, Portland Tribune, Friday. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, and this is a site, probably I'm straying a little bit, which maybe I shouldn't. I do a lot of St. Vincent de Paul work, and I work a lot with the poor. And I just could not take a settlement and keep my mouth shut when these people need to be stopped. You just got to stop them.
Thank you. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank you so much, Mr. Knox, for sharing your story. And it is one of the main reason we're passing this bill is to prevent situations. Hopefully no one else will have to go through what you went through. I just wanted to say that you said that the court ruled that you had a mortgage. And one of the things that I want to say about the law that we're passing is we made it clear in the bill that we're not doing anything inconsistent with a legal doctrine called equitable mortgage. What the court can do is they can look at a transaction, and even if it says on the paperwork, even if the paperwork says this is a sale and a lease back, if all the indication is there that it was really intended to be a loan, the court will under this doctrine called equitable mortgage, the court will say it really was a mortgage. And I don't know if that's exactly what happened in your situation.
Yes.
Good. Well, we made clear in our law that we aren't doing, even though we put really strict requirements around that type of transaction, we also made it clear in our law that nothing is designed to interfere with that doctrine, so the courts will still be able to do that. So thank you again for being here.
Mr. Blackledge. Representative Nelson, you have something?
I do.
Question?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Knox, I think you're incredible. You're my hero, and I am very, very proud of you.
Thank you.
And I'm very concerned about this situation, but let's fight it. Let's go for it. Let's go to the floor on this. Was your lawyer able to find out if this DK, whatever their name is, DK Investments, has done this to other people?
I am sure they have.
Did he find out legally that they have?
Well, DK Investment, the two main officers of DK Investment, filed bankruptcy.
Of course.
They put me down as undisclosed. They owed me an undisclosed amount. On the 12th of February, I think it's the 12th, I have the papers in my briefcase. This was in before I got the notice from the bankruptcy court. In the end of December, I get another notice from the bankruptcy court that their bankruptcy is being thrown out for bad faith in bankruptcy. Mm. I have a phone deal with the bankruptcy court. I think it's on the 12th of February. But they have tried to get away, for I couldn't do anything against them. I've been told that they are not doing the I save your home bid anymore, but they're still in real estate.
Is this Portland? May I?
This is in Portland.
Thank you.
Well, or Gresham, Portland, Fairview area. After I took them to court, their signs came down quite fast.
Thank you. Well, good for you on that.
That's for sure.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to say what the chair just said. Good for you.
Thank you, sir.
You, as Representative Nelson said, you're a hero, and we applaud you. And I hope you're able to stay in your home. I'm praying that you will be able to stay in your home.
Well, Representative Riley, I lost my wife there 15 years ago. And, excuse me, that's one of the reasons I'd like to stay there.
Sure.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Blackledge, would you like to go ahead and go forward?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Gary Blackledge. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland with the firm of Green and Markley, and I'm here on behalf of the debtor-creditor section of the Oregon State Bar. We realize that this is a very real problem. I personally have been approached by people wanting me to prepare those trust agreements like Mr. Carnes put out here, and I have also represented Chapter 7 bankruptcy trustees unwinding these kinds of transactions when the property owner has filed bankruptcy before things got as bad as what's happened to Mr. Knox. The debtor-creditor section's sole concern at this point with this bill is the foreclosure notice provision that Mr. Carnes, who testified earlier, mentioned, in that the notice in the current version in the that's in actually section 20 of the dash one amendments has in it a definite amount as of the date of the notice to cure. The debtor-creditor section believes that this is going to be very misleading and confusing to the borrowers when they get this notice, because most borrowers don't act immediately when they get a notice. They wait for weeks, sometimes months, before they do anything. And if they send in a check for that amount that was in the notice, it's going to be rejected as insufficient. I have in my written testimony provided some suggested language to replace those paragraphs that, while I attempted to make it plain English, after all, I'm a lawyer, it might not be plain English, but the point is that when the notice is sent out, there are figures that are unknown to the trustee, such as how much it's going to cost to serve the notice that has to be personally served on the occupants. Sometimes the process server has to go back several times, and those fees can get expensive. Also, there's recording fees, title premium fees. When the notice goes out, we often do not have invoices from the title companies, so we don't know what these figures are. Sometimes the lender needs to advance to pay insurance premiums or to pay taxes. I had one in September where the lender had to pay the oldest year's taxes because the tax foreclosure judgment was going to be entered. So these figures all need to be, you know, calculated. So what we're suggesting is that there be a clear in the notice a telephone number to call, and so that the borrower can call the trustee, giving the trustee a date certain that those can be calculated through. That way we can get together all of the invoices and all the costs and expenses and have them be more accurate so that there's a real a number. And so we're asking that this committee, not pass this bill without making that change, because we feel that it's just going to create more confusion and just be misleading to the borrowers that get the notice if it says, as of this date, the amount you need to cure is X.
Thank you for those comments. Have you been in touch with anybody in this work group or DCBS about this issue and are working with them to resolve your concerns with that notice?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I have been in touch with Mr. Lou Savage. This is coming down so quickly, however, that I am here just to make sure. We've been exchanging emails and whatnot, and some of my comments have arrived a little late to Mr. Savage. Part of the problem is the debtor-creditor section legislative committee are a bunch of lawyers who are working, and it's hard to get everybody together and get a consensus to provide.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate your efforts in communicating and trying to get this resolved quickly. To some, I'm sure, probably don't feel this has been moving real quickly because they've been working on it for months and months and months, so... Unfortunately, they didn't get your input earlier, but I'm sure we're going to try to accommodate your concerns in this, and because we really feel it's important to move this bill forward, so I hope that we're able to address your concerns, and certainly I hope that happens, and make sure you let me know if it does or not. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any other questions of Mr. Blackledge at this moment? Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I looked at your suggested wording for the notice, and I don't. I personally think that it's a little too complex. We need to keep with the plain language that we've been trying to stay with, and while I think we do need to make sure that the person who receives this notice needs to know that this may change. I think we have to do it more simply than this. But thank you for your input.
Thank you.
Ms. Hebb.
Representative Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb for the Oregon Law Center, and here today in support of this bill, and thank you very much for the time and attention that you and others have put into the formulation of this bill. I couldn't possibly illustrate the great need for this protection better than Mr. Knox bravely did. I will only add that I think this is a very important step in providing a comprehensive foundation of protection, and the Law Center remains interested in further discussion either later tonight or later in session as we move forward as to how we can make sure to provide a web of support for consumers in the mortgage lending industry. So thank you very much.
Thank you for that comment, and maybe I wasn't going to say it now, but we will be having an informational hearing on mortgage lending practices this evening, even though many of you have heard the Senate has canceled their meeting on that subject. We will be having an informational hearing at 6 o'clock in hearing room, one of these hearing rooms in this hall here.
C.
So where we will be looking at some other issues that are being talked about in the building. But anyway, thank you very much for bringing your testimony forward. And Mr. Blackledge, too, appreciate pointing out some concerns. With that, I'd like to ask if there's anybody signed up to testify who cannot be back here tomorrow. Would you like to come forward, please? Oh, 4 o'clock? Is the next meeting?
Mm-hmm. That's what I was just told.
Oh.
Can I ask Mr. Blackledge a question?
You're going to have to speak up because I can't see you.
Well, I saw our administrator notice two hands were down.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You might want to bring him back up.
Mr. Blackledge. Can you come back up a minute? There was a question for you that I got to check in with my vice chair a little more often, obviously. So if you can sit tight, that'd be fine. Thank you. Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
I apologize for...
That's okay. I'm such a quiet person that I'm sure you can... I just don't hardly ever say anything. Thank you. Mr. Blackledge, thank you for being here. I was just curious because the document that we're referring to regarding Section 20 seems very strange to me, and always think about my water and light bill. You know, at least when I get home, you know, they don't cut it off. I mean, they wouldn't dare. But anyway, if I'm out of town, you know, I get a warning. Do you know what I'm saying? Without their cutting it off. So I think this I don't even know what you call it, a notice on page 19 in the bill is so bad. And it just says, you know, you're in danger of losing your property if you do not take action immediately. Now, when do I get this? 30 days after I've not done something, 100 days, whatever. And what's the timeline on this? Could you answer that one first?
Please. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson. As I understand it, this notice, at least as a trustee who does foreclosures, I would send this notice with the trustee's notice of sale and the Fair Debt Collection Practices notice, so that the borrower is going to receive three notices all together. This notice being what's termed the plain English notice is that you're going to lose your property and you need to do something. The trustee's notice of sale basically sets out when that sale is going to be, what the default is, and the acceleration language of the debt. And also it contains provisions required under the Oregon Trustee Act that the borrower has the opportunity to cure the default and essentially deaccelerate the debt up to 5 days before the date of the sale. And that trustee's notice of sale must be served at least 120 days before the sale is conducted. So I personally would be sending this notice out more than 120 days before the sale date. Now, it's my experience that many times the borrowers procrastinate. They don't do anything. They think something's going to happen. Something's going to get better. And so I'm always getting calls 2 or 3 weeks before the sale saying, how much can we pay? You know, how much do we owe to get this out of foreclosure, or what's the payoff for this kind of thing? And that's when we provide them. But the problem is, by that time, there's a lot of costs and expenses and missed payments that would need to be paid to cure this amount. If they act quickly, like within a week or so after they get the notice, and this plain English notice, and with my proposal is there's a number there that they call to get that cure amount, the exact amount on a date that they anticipate that they would be able to actually cure, is maybe they're going to, you know, try to refinance, or maybe they're going to go to Aunt Sally and borrow the money, or who knows what. But they'll have to give a date, and then that cure amount can be calculated. But the sooner they do that, the less it's going to be. The longer they wait, they just don't seem to understand that things don't stand still. Things grow, and there's more expenses that are incurred as the foreclosure proceeds over that 120-day period.
Just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. I know you want to leave. But I guess my greatest concern is having the time to refinance your property. And it seems like there needs to be some mutual agreement that both parties will maximize their efforts to assist in keeping this facility in, you know, the owner's name. And I happen to be the individual that did the auction for a Colonel Reiser who lost his home in Washington County. I'm not happy about it to this day. Because Washington Mutual took it away from me. A veteran shot down 4 times for us. My concern was there was not one effort made to help this man refinance his property after his bookkeeper stole all his money from the bank. So I'm just wondering, shouldn't there be some document that says, contact us, our loan department has 30 days in which to assist you in various ways of refinancing your property, da-da-da, interest rates have dropped, or something. I mean, shouldn't there be some kind of goodwill for these people that have, you know, made all these banks so rich already?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson. That would be a good idea, but you've got to remember that not all of the trust deeds on residential properties are held by the big banks and the mortgage servicers. There's trust deeds that are carried back by a seller when they sell the property, and there's private people that loan money that aren't big banks with servicers that aren't really geared for counseling the borrower. Having said that, though, most of the banks that I represent would prefer to have money rather than the property,
right,
especially in this market. And many of them are working with folks to work out allowing them to stay in the home, and, you know, with the exchange that they're going to, you know, pay the debt. They'll sometimes renegotiate the loan and that kind of thing. And so it's true that it would be nice to, you know, say that the bank would help them refinance, but, you know, typically when there's been a default, the bank doesn't want to refinance it, and so they're not really in a position to go out and look for other banks to, you know, help this borrower refinance. I think it is good, though, to suggest that they need to in the notice, to go look for someone to help them and look at these options, to let them know what the options are. Incidentally, my partner has represented the Colonel pro bono for years as a result of that.
I'd like to thank you very, very much.
Yeah.
Jim Bonamici, did you hear?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions there, Mr. Blackledge? Thank you. We're going to let you go again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Stay tuned. And hello. Hi. Would you state your name for the record,
sure,
please?
My name is John Sheldon, and I represent Equity Home Solutions. We're local real estate investors in the greater Portland area. And I appreciate the time to talk to the committee and for all the work that they've done on the bill. My written testimony might be a little bit more testy than the questions I have for you. I've never been in this setting before. I understand there's been, you know, definitely been some issues with some foreclosure consultants that have made the news media, and a lot of people, and some people have been hurt.
Bless you.
However, I feel with the people that I know and the other real estate investors in the Portland area, there are far, far more people being helped in foreclosure than are being hurt by the few that are out there unscrupulous. I've read the bill a couple of times, and I'm still confused over certain things, especially how it pertains to how we do business. And I'd like to ask you those questions, if that's proper at this time. And also let you know some things that I think are missed or seem misdirected in the bill. It seems by reading the bill that it infers most people who are in default have equity in their property and have some ability to get caught up on their arrears. From personal experience with dozens and dozens and dozens of people that we talk to on a monthly basis, and hundreds of people that my peers, real estate investors, that's just not the case. I would say at least 9 out of 10 of the people that call us have no equity in their property. Now, I understand where this gentleman owed 162, I think, and the appraisal was 190. It may look like that's $30,000 worth of equity, but in reality, with the cost of selling a home, time on market, repairs, et cetera. It's not a true $30,000. There's many expenses involved there. We usually look see expenses far in excess of 10% of the cost of selling a home. The selling price of the home would cost in excess of 10% to actually sell it. I don't think people understand that. And other gentlemen over here, Mr. Blackledge was correct. Many people, they are in denial when they get these letters. They really don't know what's happening, and they just don't do anything for months and months and months. And refinancing is, in those situations, almost never happens because these people already have poor credit from being behind and have usually some financial situation that came up that would prevent them from being bankable by a new lender. As far as our company, we never do anything in the form of leasebacks or anything that would give someone the idea that they're going to be able to keep their home. What we do is when these people are underwater, upside down on their property, or very close to upside down. Like if someone owes if a house is worth $200,000, and someone owes $180,000, $185,000, every month they owe more because they're not paying, they really don't have any equity as we see it. Does that make sense? So what we often do is we will enter into a contract to purchase the property at less than what's owed on it, and then we will assist the owner we work on behalf of the owner and ourselves to talk to the bank to see if the bank negotiate with the bank to see if they will sell the property for less than what's owed on it. In terms, it's called a short sale. And in that, if we are successful, we are able to save the seller from having a foreclosure on their record. We save the bank from taking a property back that they don't want at terms that they agree to. And in the course, we will generally make some money. We're in business. We have expertise. And I see there's three winners in that situation: the seller, the bank, and us, and the community at large, because there's less vacant and blighted homes left on the market. And when houses turn more quickly, the bank does take a little bit of a loss, but we're able to resell those homes at a profit and fix them up in the process. I'm unclear, after reading the bill, whether our strategy in helping these people is addressed by the bill or not. We don't call ourselves foreclosure consultants. We don't take any pay for being foreclosure consultants. We do offer to buy their home and negotiate with the bank. And if we're successful, we then will make some money by reselling the house. Can anyone on the committee answer that question? Maybe Representative Bonamici? Because you helped construct the... You write it, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not going to try. I don't know. Definitely don't know enough about your business, and don't want to venture to guess how it applies or whether it does apply. But I wanted to ask you: are you licensed as a realtor? Do you have any kind of state license at all?
No, we're not. We buy. We're local real estate investors. We buy houses as principal in the purchase, and then we sell the house as a principal in the sale. So
In my understanding, we don't need to be licensed since we're principal in the transaction. We own the house. We're buying it and we're selling it. But I would like to ask, I know it talks a lot, and the bill talks a lot about foreclosure consultants that are paid a fee. We are not paid a fee up front. And instead of being a court case later to test this bill, I'd like an understanding from the people who helped write the bill, if that's proper in this forum, and I don't know that, to understand.
Well, and I appreciate your concern and appreciate you coming forward, and I can't specifically, I'm not even sure what your question is at this point, but I know the industry that's in the room, and certainly DCBS, could probably give you more specifics about how this would apply to your situation specifically if this were to become law. So, I'm probably going to defer you to those that have been, as we're still studying the concepts in this bill and trying to parse that out. I'm not even sure what your question is. So, other than, are you a foreclosure consultant under this definition? I don't know if I can answer that question for you right now. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question for you. You mentioned three winners: the bank, the consumer, the homeowner, right, and you.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain to me what the gain is for the homeowner? What do you do for them? What is that?
The gain for the homeowner is to avoid having a foreclosure on their record, which makes things very difficult for them for years and years and years.
Yeah.
And most people would like to avoid that, and we help them do that.
Okay, thank you.
And certainly, we can probably discuss your specific case offline, outside of this setting, and see if we can figure out what the parameters are of this bill as it affects you are, and then have a better understanding of the implications of this bill on people like you that are, in the industry and perhaps in the industry legitimately and doing a certain service to some. So, Representative Nelson, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
I skipped over you out of turn.
That's okay. Mr. Sheldon, thanks for being here. But, what I just find so difficult to understand is why, and I've done this for many people over my lifetime, I've negotiated for businesses for them to buy their office equipment at a reduced rate when they hit some tough times. I mean, all these things. Well, here's what happens with our people is, number one, they lose a job. Number two, they're ill. I mean, those are just about the two big issues, regardless, of their personal debt, consumer debt. But what I want to make happen is what you're doing for yourself, we're doing for these people to help them. And I have such a anti-balloon payment mentality because I've seen it just kill many, many, young couples' hopes for the future when they get into a house that with a big fat balloon payment, and when it's time, they haven't got it, they had a baby instead. So I'm just, concerned that we're skilled and have this expertise, but to help everybody but the homeowner. Why would you offer me that service for how much money? You go negotiate with Washington Mutual for this Colonel Reiser, for example.
Yeah.
Could I pay you to do that? So that he could refinance his house at a lesser value?
Excuse me. The banks will not offer a short sale to the homeowner directly.
That's why I'm asking you. Would you do it for me?
the bank will not, that would be a renegotiation of the loan. What you're asking is for a renegotiation of the loan.
Would you do that for me?
We have suggested that to people in the past and helped them in the past, but I don't know that. It's not our current model because I'm not sure if it's... We suggest that they may be able to do that. I've shied away from that because I think it borders on some laws that I'm not familiar with. We have offered to do forbearance agreements for people. Actually, we've done it for free. The reason we actually do that, I mean, most forbearance agreements don't last. These people are behind for a reason. It's usually because they lost a job or an illness, and more often than not, it's either not the balloons but an adjustable rate mortgage. And just about more often than not, people don't know how to manage their money, and they get in trouble.
Thank you, Mr. Sheldon. And before your testimony gets any of us or you in future trouble, maybe we'll dispense with that and appreciate your testimony. And perhaps you can talk with some offline, and maybe we can answer some of your specific questions about your case and how this legislation might impact that. I'm not specifically sure we can address your specific issues right now. I don't know that we have time to do that in this committee right now. So I appreciate your testimony. I appreciate you bringing the issue up for us to ponder on as well. So I'm sure that we'll have some discussions around that scenario that you're presenting to us.
Well, thank you very much for your time, and I would be glad to participate in any work group or any discussion with people who are helping write or rewrite parts of the bill to really keep the bad guys out,
mm-hmm.
and let the people who are doing a genuine service be able to do that.
Yeah,
and not tie our hands too much.
And that's what we're trying to accomplish. And I think we're pretty far down the road that that's what this bill does, but is not going to put legitimate people out of business in so doing. So with that, I really do appreciate you coming forward, and I'd like to, I got a few more people I need to get on the record here that have signed up to testify, and my time is starting to run out. So
thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Appreciate your work.
Thank you, Mr. Sheldon. I'd like to bring up John McCauley and Shane Jackson and Gary Oxley. Are you still here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John McCauley representing the Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals, and I'm here today just to say that our organization of mortgage brokers supports House Bill 3630. Our members participated actively in the work group that brought this bill to you. We think it addresses some real issues that as you've heard, and so we commend it to you for your positive action.
Thank you for that short, concise statement of support.
I shall also attempt to be as brief as possible. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for this opportunity. My name is Shane Jackson. I'm the registered lobbyist for the Oregon Coalition of Mortgage Originators. I'm very pleased to be appointed to the governor's mortgage lending work group also, and was a observer of the whole process that created House Bill 3630, and would say that a lot of great work was done, very thorough, it was a real pleasure to watch this being formed. And I also would like to add a stress of urgency. This is one of the few things that I do think we should do as soon as possible. Oregon's real estate has been able to maintain a value coming into this market, and what I would see is that we possibly could be seen by these mortgage rescue scammers as very ripe fruit of having a high equity value, and would be it would be very tempting for them to come to Oregon and attempt to operate here because of our high real estate values. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. And identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Sean Jillians, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. Mr. Oxley was signed in on our behalf, and so I'll jump in and just say we were a part of the governor's work group, and we're supportive of this bill as it came forward. We think it's a good step towards protecting consumers in Oregon.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee of these industry representatives?
Yes, I have a question.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you. Thank you very much for being here. Shane, Sean, and John. That's hard to say, Shane, Sean, and John. I'm just curious, since you're in this business, how frequent have these scam artists attacked our Oregonians?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I have not heard any statistics from our members as to that, and I guess I would defer to a regulator who may receive complaints. I don't have the answer to your specific question.
Sean, do you know?
I would repeat that. We
don't know?
We don't know quite yet.
Don't know who your competitors are?
No.
I would just like to help you.
The amount of foreclosures in Oregon as relative to the rest of the country is still relatively low. And so there's just the opportunity to participate in that business in Oregon has thus remained relatively low. So if I was in this business, I wouldn't be as attracted to Oregon because of the volume.
Just one quick follow-up. I'm going to help you with some names, and because this makes me very sick in my own county. And you know, we had many individuals who came to this country and worked their buns off to own a home. You know, the dream of every individual, every family, and every veteran. And because of their language difficulty, they have everything taken away from them. These were Hispanics. Hispanics treating other Hispanics very poorly because they didn't understand the system. So I just think, you know, that if y'all don't know, you need to know who these people are. And I don't know who, whether it's any attorney general's office or what, but your members need to be advised of these individuals preying on helpless people, not only the Hispanics, but also on some senior citizens. And I just happen to know of these two areas right now that are very upsetting to me.
Mr. Chair, if I might, real quick, Representative Nelson. I think a big part of this is, despite the fact that we don't know the actual numbers for how many of these have occurred, this is a proactive step to ensure that it doesn't happen in the future, and that's why we're pushing this bill forward.
Thank you for that, Sean. Thank you, gentlemen, and also for your individual efforts and work on this committee and task force to bring this bill to the legislature. Appreciate your efforts. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next up, I'd like to have Steve Buckstein.
Steve Policy Institute. Great tie.
Thank you. I'll try to be brief, Mr. Chairman. You're closing at 3. Is that the case?
Are we going past 3? Healthcare is not starting at 3.
All right. So, if excuse me for just a minute. We are over our time limit right now, committee members. The next committee coming in is not coming in until 4. Actually, I've been informed. If you have other responsibilities, feel free to depart. I'm going to try to have a few more people testify to get them their time on the record. Since the room is available right now, I'm going to take advantage of it. So, thank you. Excuse me. Go ahead.
Sure. Chair Holby and members of the committee, my name is Steve Buckstein. I'm senior policy analyst and a founder of Cascade Policy Institute in Portland. And I just wanted to bring up some things to consider. I fully agree that we need to stop scam artists, we need to stop fraud, we need to have tough laws against fraud, we need to have full disclosure, but we shouldn't be looking at limiting people's options, even if you think those options are bad ones. And I have some recent research from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York that I'd just like to present to you to sort of keep this in perspective. The 2007 Oregon legislature passed a law that limited interest rates on payday loans, which is a similar situation. This bill specifically you're looking at now would limit interest rates, as I understand it, to 9% from these so-called foreclosure consultants as part of the bill. And we don't know what happened yet, I don't think, with people who have been using payday lenders in Oregon, because the time is so recent. Many of their, most of those companies went out of business because of the cap on interest rates that the legislature placed on them. But the Federal Reserve Bank of New York has completed a study that they released in November, and I have a link on my written testimony where you can see the whole 44-page report, that implies that in other states where payday loans specifically were banned in 2004 and 2005, the results weren't what the legislatures expected. And I just want to read you the abstract, the short one paragraph abstract from that report, keeping in mind what might be happening here when you restrict options in another area, in this case mortgage loans and foreclosure, so-called foreclosure consultants. The report stated that payday loans are widely condemned as a predatory debt trap. We test that claim, this is the author speaking, we test that claim by researching how households in Georgia and North Carolina have fared since those states banned payday loans in May of 2004 and in December of 2005, respectively. Compared with households in all other states, households in these states, specifically in Georgia, have bounced more checks, complained more to the Federal Trade Commission about lenders and debt collectors, and filed for Chapter 7 bankruptcy protection at a higher rate. North Carolina households have fared about the same, they say. This negative correlation, meaning reduced payday credit supply equals increased credit problems, just the opposite of what you've been hoping for, contradicts the debt trap critique of payday lending, but is consistent with the hypothesis that payday credit is preferable to substitutes, such as the bounced check, quote-unquote, protection sold by credit unions and banks, or loans from pawn shops, unquote. So it appears that trying to do good for people, in this case banning or restricting interest rates on loans that legislatures feel are inappropriate, actually can backfire and can actually harm the very people that you're trying to help. So I am fully in support of laws that make it clear what's going on, notices, probably clearer than they are now, making people aware of what the terms of loans or foreclosure agreements or whatever they are, making sure in this case, homeowners know what those terms are. But I would encourage you to resist the urge to actually limit the options of those homeowners, because in your zeal to help them, I think you may be hurting others. And there's a postulate in economics called the seen and the unseen. You will see the people that you help, but you will not see the people that were hurt, because they never come forward. They didn't have the opportunity to take advantage of whatever that that option was, and you don't hear from them. You do hear from the people that are hurt, like the gentleman before, and stopping those kind of fraudulent practices is obviously perfectly appropriate. But in your zeal to help those people, don't hurt others who have their choices limited. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Bonamici?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to see you back again. I saw you when you visited the Healthcare Committee. I wanted to clarify a couple of things. First of all, we looked at a lot of other states' approaches to this particular problem, and the approach that we took was basically a disclosure approach, not taking away options. Many states, in fact, we had discussions about the whole equity purchase, the sale, leaseback. Some states banned that. We had people say that practice ought to be banned. We chose not to ban it. but to instead put clear disclosures around it. And most importantly, the 9% interest limitation that you're talking about doesn't have to do with the mortgage. That has to do with, for example, if the foreclosure consultant spends some money on behalf of the homeowner and then the homeowner cancels the contract, the homeowner has to pay back the money that the foreclosure consultant spent, and the foreclosure consultant can't charge the consumer more than 9% interest. So it just has to do with the refund amount of the money expended on the homeowner's behalf. It doesn't have to do with any sort of underlying cap on any mortgage or fee. It just has to do with the refund amount. So I think we're in agreement on a lot of points. So we did basically take the disclosure, and the disclosures are pretty thorough, I think. But I think they should be pretty thorough. But that's basically the approach that we took in this bill.
Chair Holby, Representative Bonamici, I applaud you. Then I just wanted to again make sure that we don't go down this road, because there are other bills involved. There's two in the Senate, I guess, in terms of mortgage brokers. This is a foreclosure consultant one. Disclosure is fine. Limiting options, I think, is bad. So to the extent that you haven't limited options, I applaud you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Buckstein. Any further questions? Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Rick Bennett and Matt Wallace. Next up, we don't have.
Maybe that last.
Where did he go?
So at
that fire sale.
That does exhaust our. Sign-up sheet at the moment, and at this time, I was hoping I could get Corey Streisinger back on the hot seat. And
you had a question, didn't you?
As long as it's not about toy safety.
Oh, that's not going to your departments, right?
Apparently not.
Not yet.
Go ahead. Run that.
So, Representative Nelson, I believe, had a question for you.
I do. Could you hire me?
In what capacity?
Can I call her out of order?
Uh-oh. You can't do that? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think there's so many things we could do. But do we have any kind of a ombudsman for consumers in our department? Like
Chair,
that man that was giving those loans or buying those houses?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, and again, I'm Corey Streisinger for the record, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. We, in our consumer finance area, we don't have someone with the title of ombudsman, but we do help people on a regular basis. So we would encourage someone who is harmed by one of our regulated industries to get in touch with us. We do have enforcement powers, and we will look into those situations. One of the challenges about this mortgage rescue industry, if you will, is it is not regulated. It's not regulated by our department. And I believe one of the questions that was asked of the gentleman who testified earlier was, are you licensed by any state agency? Are you a real estate broker? Are you a licensed lender? Are you in any of those categories? And the answer was no. One of the issues that was discussed in the work group in connection with this bill is, should we look at a licensure program so that people engaging in these types of arrangements would need to be registered or licensed with a state agency? We decided not to take that approach because the people who engage in this activity, and as you've heard, cross a broad spectrum. Some of them are legitimate, some of them are scam artists, and we didn't want to be in the situation of having a basically governmental seal of approval on an activity that we might not approve of. And so the decision of the work group was not to go for a licensure model, but instead, as has been mentioned and as Representative Bonamici just mentioned, to go for a disclosure model and to set standards that anyone engaging in these activities has to comply with, not to prohibit it, but also not to bless it, if you will.
Just one quick follow-up.
Follow-up, please.
Thank you. It just seems there's nowhere to go for these people. We're greatly underfund legal aid.
Some of these people wouldn't even qualify for legal aid, but yet they do need it because they're about to lose their only asset that they have. I mean, many of these seniors have no car anymore even.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, we have been assembling counseling resources. And the list that I showed you earlier, which is also posted on our website, is a whole range of counseling services that work with people who are facing foreclosure. And there's a national toll-free number that for national counseling, but then there are also credit counseling, consumer counseling resources in communities across Oregon. So anyone who contacts us who is in a situation of potentially losing their home to foreclosure, we would be happy to put them in touch with resources for people who can, in fact, counsel them and offer them advice, talk about what they might want to deal with their lender on, what their options are. And the notice provisions in this bill, the foreclosure notice, will give people a hotline to call to find out about a counseling resource in their community, and also will provide them with referral to legal resources.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions, Representative Gillian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here. You don't have to answer my questions since, as you know, I work tirelessly, although unsuccessfully, to add things to your workload. But from your perspective on that task force, you know, this group that we haven't quite identified, but we know are consultants or equity purchasers. The ones that wear the white hats in that group, if I'm defining that group properly, we had a previous testifier, it's a little hard to define. But in that group, if there are those that wear white hats, do you feel like the task force adequately identified and took into consideration their interests in this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, I do, actually, and you may want to talk to some of the other folks in the work group, but we had a number of people in the work group who were articulating fairly clearly what the legitimate end of this business was about, how it works, and what was appropriate in order to ensure that it could continue to work with constraints and with disclosure. But there was discussion about, as Representative Bonamici mentioned, whether to ban this practice or not, and the consensus of the group was no, there is a legitimate end of the business, and we should not prohibit it. We should make sure that it works well.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. I just want to add to what Director Streisinger was saying. With regard to the foreclosure consultants especially, there's a pretty significant list of exemptions. It's on page 2 of the bill. I don't know what page it's on of the dash 1. I'm just looking at page 2. And those are, for example, people who are acting within the scope of a license. For example, an attorney, banks, trust companies, credit unions, etc., a subsidiary of those, the judgment creditor, title insurance company, mortgage broker, mortgage lender, acting within the scope of their license, real estate licensee, etc. Because those licensees are, when they're acting under the scope of their license, doing what they're licensed for, often conducting this type of work. And so they're exempt from this if they're not acting within the scope of their license. If they're, for example, a mortgage broker who decides, well, I'm going to go out and do this foreclosure consulting, then they're subject to this particular provision.
The previous testifier made me start thinking about this, so I can understand the licensing part, but I'm just concerned, or at least curious, I guess, about those that don't fall in the licensing part but are involved, and if we have addressed them.
Are you asking me a question?
Kind of.
Well, if they don't
question, Representative Gilliam?
If they don't fall within the exemption, then they follow the provisions of the disclosure provisions of the bill.
So it would cover them as well, obviously.
If they're not exempt, then and they're engaged in the activity that's defined as foreclosure consulting, then they're subject to the bill.
Yeah.
So, Mr. Chair, please.
Representative Nelson.
So, Representative Bonamici, the individual who was up here with the Equitable Homes, whatever, where does he fall? I don't see anything on this list.
Well, I'm still contemplating that.
Ms. Streisinger, would you like to participate in this conversation?
Thank
where
you,
does he
Mr. Chair.
Fall?
I would say, without detailed knowledge of his business, I wouldn't want to express an opinion about that, but I would want to encourage him to offer any clarification that he may feel is appropriate. He seems to fall, again, without deep knowledge of his business, within the equity purchaser category. If he is also engaging in the consulting category, then he would need to make a modification to his business practices under this bill, because the bill prohibits you from simultaneously acting as a foreclosure consultant and an equity purchaser. But he says that he does not accept a fee except through the purchase transaction. Again, I couldn't express an opinion on his business practice. If he feels a clarification is appropriate, I would encourage him to come up forward with language. But there are some types of business practices that may need to be modified under the terms of the bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson,
real quick.
Okay.
I just want to say, because I'm concerned, you know, we cap those rates at 36%, you know, finally get that done. And I'm worried that we're just open in this area for an individual, like, heaven forbid, but I could go back to my home town and go into business right now doing this and call myself a... representative, not state, but I'm doing the same thing. That's just like we're just talking. I'm doing the same thing that these individuals we're trying to, you know, help streamline are doing. And I'm just worried that we're not opening a can of worms.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I think the comment was made. We're trying to get ahead of this problem. We have seen it in Oregon. We want to put some pretty strong sidebars around it while it's still a modest problem instead of a huge problem.
Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? I would like to ask you one question. This is the reason I called you up. I wanted to ask a question. But I'm curious, the gentleman from the debtor-creditor section of the Oregon State Bar, I guess, wasn't involved, or the State Bar wasn't involved in the formation of this bill as much as maybe I would have liked, perhaps, not due to your actions or inactions, but just time, I think, and logistics, perhaps. But is there a way to accommodate his issues with the notice at this late hour and bring this bill into to address his issues and still accomplish what we're trying to accomplish?
Mr. Chair, I think there is. As I understand it, the legitimate concern is not providing a static number without also conveying that number will change.
Mm-hmm.
The notice, as drafted, includes a telephone number to call to find the actual number, and I think it's some fairly modest changes. My reaction was somewhat the same as Representative Riley's, which is the language submitted to us was maybe a little more cumbersome than we're trying to have in this notice for the really the plain language audience. But we're happy to take a crack at making it maybe a little simpler, but still capturing the concern.
That's what I was hoping. I didn't know if you were officially doing that as the governor's task force, or whether I'm going to now name your task force as my work group to try to get that accomplished in a short period of time.
Whatever label you choose to attach to it, we're intending to get it addressed.
Pick whichever one you would like. I just like the end result, I think. So I appreciate your effort in that. I have a late sign-in. Judy Moore would like to speak.
My name is Judy Moore, and I am a real estate investor, very much similar to what you heard from John Sheldon. And as I sit and listen and look at what I do and what my goals are, and yet even have investor friends that have been taken advantage of by other investors, which it makes me sad and irate all at the same time. It's like, I think what John's trying to say and what I'm here to say too is that there is a niche and there is a need for what real estate investors do. And as I look at this, I mean, I walk away with the same question saying, I want to be lawful. I want to sleep at night. I want to feel good about what I do. And I do right now, but I don't know where I fit in this.
Sure.
And so I thought maybe I could give you just a quick story to tell you what I do, how I do it, and why I think I need to be protected. I'm not licensed. I mean, I have other licenses. I don't use them with what I'm doing. But I have a homeowner right now that I'm working with. Her name's Anna. She's a Hispanic woman. She lives down in Woodburn. She bought a house in, about May of 06. And she was sold. English is her second language. She anticipated getting into this house. It's a huge house. It's an 8-bedroom, 5-bath in very, very bad disrepair. And she was kind of sold a bill of goods because she quit her job. She got into this house. It was a foster care situation for people that were, you know, pretty healthy but still needed some place to stay. And when she asked her real estate agent, I need an appraisal. He said, no, you don't need it. You'll be okay. So she was kind of railroaded into this house without an appraisal, without any representation, as the agent represented both the buyer and the seller. The day or two before closing, she had a friend go in, looked at the house, the deck's falling off. I mean, I have a bid on this house for $88,000 of repair. And that doesn't include replacing the windows, taking off the 6 layers of roof that the neighbor says is there, or insulating the house. And her bill is $700 a month if she heats this house in the wintertime. So her and her son, she's a single mom, cancer survivor, just a good, good lady who says, I don't want to file bankruptcy. You know, I don't do that. So she's living in just a couple rooms of this big house while the bank is foreclosing. So that's where I come in, is, you know, she's in foreclosure. I didn't create it. I can't stop it. I mean, I wish I could fix. I wish I could send her to an agency that could stop it. I want to step back for a second. After she got into this house, really what caused her to be in the situation is she was told by the real estate agent, you don't need an appraisal. The house is watched very closely by the state because it has to be licensed. Well, as soon as she bought it, the state came in, took a look at the house, and said, you don't meet code, which she doesn't. I mean, there's many reasons she doesn't. But she doesn't meet code. You cannot take in any new clients. And so she tried to use the available money she had. She's poured her whole life savings into this house, and she's going to lose it anyway. And it still doesn't meet satisfactory standards for the... I mean, it's licensed now, but when people come into the house, they quickly leave again. It needs too many repairs. Okay, so back to what I do. What I'm doing working with her is, I mean, she's going to lose the house, and I'm trying to do a short sale with the bank. And that's not an easy process. I mean, and like John said, a bank won't do a short sale with a homeowner because otherwise any homeowner in Oregon could say, I don't like my interest rate. I don't like what's going on with my house. So bank, you know, renegotiate with me. And I mean, that just opens up a whole new area of scams for banks. And I mean, it would be a mess. But I'm in the process with her of negotiating a short sale with a bank. Her house is going to go to the sale or the auction on the 8th. And I've had an email in and some correspondence back and forth with Wells Fargo Bank. She has a first and a second, both with Wells Fargo. And hopefully they're going to postpone the sale a month just because of the long process and having to get another BPO because they sold the first mortgage. But what I've done in the process and what other investors do is she can't go out and buy a house right now because her credit's destroyed. And she doesn't have enough money. I mean, she can afford maybe $700 at tops right now for a payment. And so investors who have gone out and have bought houses outright, we end up doing lease options with people that have damaged credit. They cannot get a bank loan. But we can work out a deal with them that is a deal for them, a deal for us, where they can get back into the market again. They can buy a house. We give them, I mean, I tell, this Anna's called me and said, you know, somebody said in 4 months I can have my credit repaired. I said, Anna, it's a scam. You have to have 36 months. There's no way. You've got to have 36 months of being able to make payments, repair your credit so that you even have so that you can go back to the bank and get a mortgage. So with her, it's kind of a happy story because all of my callings around, she's kind of told me what she wants. Again, I'm not licensed. So when I go in, I buy a house and I, you know, end up finding the money one way or another, I purchase a house so that when I'm doing whatever I do on the other end, I'm not stepping in the middle of, you know, assigning or doing a double close. I'm buying a house. And then, so I've been looking for other houses in the Independence, Dallas, Monmouth area that are also distressed situations. Not that I caused, wish I could fix it, I can't. But to work another short sale where I can then go back to Anna and say, Anna, I've got a house for you. You know, it's, I can sell it to her under market because I got it under market from the bank. And so that's when John's saying a win-win. That's where I see win-win, because we are filling a niche and we are helping these people that are, have damaged credit, good jobs, good people, but they just don't fit in the system. So I would also just say again what has already been said here prior to me is, you know, don't limit the options. Something needs to be done, but there's still a niche out there that real estate investors, you know, are doing good. The good ones are doing good and helping people. So, you know, whatever you do, don't limit those options for those homeowners. Thank you.
Thank you for adjusting. Representative Nelson, a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Quick question, please.
A quick question. Do you have to carry insurance, liability insurance?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there any other questions?
I have one.
For Ms. Moore? You have a question of her? Could you come back up? We weren't quite done with you yet.
What was her name?
It was Judy, I believe. Judy Moore.
Sorry.
Thanks for being here. We're trying to understand your niche. How would you have met somebody like Anna? How would the relationship have started?
Several different ways. I mean, there's, you see the signs in the newspaper, the I buy signs, you know, the signs alongside the road. You know, there's times when I'll actually, you know, word of mouth. You know, I talk to people out in neighborhoods. You know, I've been door knocking before. You know, I've made phone calls. You know, I do all kinds of things, you know, to try to get my name out there.
Okay. That's helpful. Thank you.
So, relationship that you have with the banks of being able to buy these or make these short sales, as you call them, where you buy the house under market.
Mm-hmm.
So you do that to prevent the foreclosure, or after the foreclosures happen, you do that?
No, after. There's the notice of delinquency, and then they talked about the 120 days.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working in that 120 days prior to the house going to the sale.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So, I have a question.
Representative
Very Bonamage. Quick question. Thank you, Mr. Bonamage. Chair.
So, a quick question.
So you say you're a real estate investor. So which property are you buying? Are you buying the big house that's actually buying? And then what are you going to do with that?
I haven't actually decided yet. I have several exit strategies. Ones I've considered just, you know, fixing it up and then hanging on to it, just renting it out.
And then you're finding, follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
And then you're finding another house for this Anna to purchase?
I do not have, you know, a contract with her. She understands that. I actually found an 82-year-old woman in all my phone calling that she's going to move into. And I can't remember if the lady has 5 acres and 6 cows or 6 cows and 5 acres. But she's literally moving in with this 82-year-old woman that, you know, just from out being in the community knocking, I was able to put those two people together. So that's what Anna's going to do for now. She's delighted. Ethel's delighted. Everybody's happy. But, I mean, I will keep Anna, you know, on my back burner as far as knowing what she wants, the neighborhood she wants, what she can afford. And if I can buy another house, which I'm looking, where out in the area that she wants, I'll buy it under market. I'll sell it to her under market. I still make some money. She can afford it. I sleep at night. You know, it's actually a pretty nice business where I feel like it truly is a win-win for everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else that at this time would like to testify on House Bill 3630? Seeing none, I appreciate that. I believe I'm going to carry this bill over to tomorrow.
And Mr. Chair, do you wish to continue this for additional hearing, or would you like to set it for a work session and have people come discuss some of the details of some of the changes, or what would you like to do on that? Probably should tell people what your intentions are.
Well, my intentions would be to do all of those. So we will have a little bit more public testimony, and if work session is possible for us to adopt amendments, you know, I will check in with the work group or the governor's task force and see what amendments they have ready to move forward at this time, and then we will proceed accordingly tomorrow. It may be a short meeting, or it may be a long one. So with that, I'd also like to remind those that are interested that we will be having a informational hearing at 6 p.m. in hearing room
C
on mortgage lending practices. So I appreciate the testimony. Appreciate everybody paying attention and getting through this, and appreciate all the work that's gone into this too, especially. Anything else I need to cover?
Just want to close the work session or close the hearing, and we'll be okay.
So, with that, I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 3630. And any other business of the committee? I think I've pretty well covered it. Thanks for your attention, committee.
Have a very good day.
I can't believe you thought we were paying attention. You think we were paying attention? We were paying attention.
With that, I'm adjourning the House Committee.